The Sunstone Theological Society presents Blood Atonement, Capital Crimes, and Mormon Murders. Recorded live at the 1988 Sunstone Theological Symposium, held August 17th through the 20th, 1988. We take you to the University Park Hotel in Salt Lake City, Utah, where the program is just now beginning.
All here. Is that... You can't hear. Is that better? Okay, I guess we have to put our lips practically right on the microphone here. As you'll find out in my introduction, that's one of my pet peeves, is not getting my money's worth at the symposium because I'm not able to hear everybody that talks. So I'm going to ask everybody that speaks to speak very loudly. My name is Bob Vernon. I'm an attorney here in Salt Lake City, and I am the chairman of this session. To make sure you're in the right room, this is the session that will feature the paper Blood Atonement, Capital Crimes, and Mormon Murders. The admission to this session is by name tag or ticket only. So if you have not gone through that process, please see the registration desk out in the foyer so that we can make sure we'll be able to pay all the freight. The paper for this session, Blood Atonement, Capital Crimes, and Mormon Murders, will be given by Dr. C. Jess Grosbeck, and he will take about 38 minutes or so, and then the comment on that will be given by Dr. Owen E. Clark, and he will have about 8 minutes, and then that should leave us about 15 minutes or so for questions or comments afterwards. If you don't remember anything else from my introduction, please remember two things, loud and brief. Please no mini lectures. We do want you to have ample time to state the substance of your comment or question, but please try and condense it as briefly as possible so that we can understand it and so that participants can give an answer in response to what you're actually asking. Do not be afraid to talk loudly. Either come up here to the microphone and feel free to use that. I would prefer that. First of all, because it's so difficult to hear if you stand up and face away from half the people that are here. You cannot hear them, a person at all, if you're standing behind him. And that's been one of my frustrations in some of the other sessions. So please either come up to the microphone and talk directly into it, as I should be doing here, I guess. I apologize. I guess you really have to practically kiss the microphone. Talk directly into it. Or if you're in the middle of a row and it's inconvenient for you to get out and you just have a very brief question or comment, then and please yell. Don't be afraid to yell. I guarantee you, no one will be offended. Just don't be timid, because I want to hear what you have to say, and I'm sure the participants especially do. They want to know how to answer it. The participants are Dr. C. Jess Grosbeck, who is a psychiatrist, and the commentator is Dr. Owen E. Clark, who is also a practicing psychiatrist. Dr. Grosbeck was born in Seattle, Washington. He was raised in Springville, Utah. He has lived many places in Utah and California. He now resides in Provo, Utah. He practices there. He has a family consisting of a wife and 5 children. He tells me that his family is continually analyzing him, and that is what keeps him sane. He says he has a very creative and loving family, but nevertheless, they challenge him at every turn. And he seems like a very well-adjusted psychiatrist. To me, I haven't known him very long, but psychiatrists sometimes have the reputation of having a lot of problems themselves. That's constantly thrown at me by people who don't like psychiatrists. Jess is a thoroughly delightful man. He appears to me to be such, and I think we'll be very happy with his presentation. I forgot to put this in my notes, but for those of you that subscribe to Sunstone, and I hope that includes all of us, you will probably note that Jess has the distinction of having the cover article in the most recent issue that I have received anyway on the psychohistory of the Joseph Smith family. A very good article, which was his talk at the Sunstone Symposium last year. And Jess tells me that he has three talks on that, and I can believe him, because every time I picked up a Sunstone Symposium program over the last few years, he's talking on that subject. And so he has three articles on that, and he informs me that the other two will be out shortly in future issues of Sunstone. So he's probably the world's leading authority. And it would have been interesting to see the Smith family on the couch with him 150 some odd years ago. Jess has fulfilled seven missions, which staggers my mind, for service. Three missions in 7 years. I'm sorry. That still staggers my mind. It's all I could do to get through one. He's been a stake mission president. He currently teaches in the church, in Sunday school, is that right?
Sometimes,
yeah. He's a teacher. He loves teaching. One of his favorite hobbies, he says, is is presiding over the Grosbeck Genealogical Organization. Now, Dr. Owen, excuse me, I better tell you that Jess is professionally associate professor of psychiatry at the University of California, the University of Utah College of Medicine, training analyst, Interregional Society of Jungian Analysts, forensic psychiatrist in the practice of legal medicine and forensic psychiatry, Provo, Utah, and Sacramento, California. So he is very active in what he does. Owen Clark was raised in Idaho on a ranch and still gets dirt under his fingernails, he informs us. He studied the history of science at Harvard College, and then medicine, specializing in psychiatry at the University of Washington and Yale University. He served an LDS mission in Austria, did summer research in Germany, and fulfilled military duty at Fort Lewis, south of Seattle, where he now lives. He practices general psychiatry, loves his wife, Barbara, who is a physician specializing in pediatric oncology, and watches with awe as their three children mature. His efforts to understand the scriptures and the gospel at the present are primarily centered in his role as a teacher in the gospel gospel doctrine class in Sunday school. So without any further ado, we will turn the balance of the next 45 minutes or so over to Dr. Grosbeck and Dr. Clark, and then we will have your comments.
Thank you for that introduction. I hope you'll notice the inspiration of the Sunstone Foundation here, who put an attorney to preside over this session. And I think Bob Vernon is well capable of doing that. Today I hope to talk about some weighty matters, but before I get into them, I want to make a small family confession. As you know, mental illness is often associated with fraud, and we're going to be talking about that, as it's associated with a lot of things. I remember when I was just starting my practice, and it was still difficult to go, not too many patients, and one time I was telling our children who wanted this or that to do, and I told them we couldn't afford it. And at one point, one of our daughters, Jenny, who is here in the audience today, She must have been about 9 or 10. She paused for a moment when I was telling her we didn't have the money to do this. I was building the practice, didn't have that many patients, and she paused and said, "Well, Dad, just tell them they're crazy for just 2 weeks longer." So I hope she remembers that in her budding work as a psychologist, just she's what she's going to become. The mixture of religion and mental illness is age old. Interestingly, it would appear anthropologically that in all cultures, the difference is always known between those who are creative in a religious and spiritual sense versus those who are mentally ill or crazy. Nevertheless, when cultures become complicated, stressed through growth, this boundary line sometimes becomes very thin and difficult to distinguish. As Mormons living in a Utah culture, as well as Mormons throughout the world, this is a particularly timely question, because while we come from a rich and varied background of at times creative spiritual experience, we have also seen recent examples of religion intertwined with manifestations of criminal acts involving murder, robbery, and fraud. Mental illness has surfaced in these events too, in particular, it surrounds such unusual Mormon doctrines as blood atonement as it interrelates with capital crimes that one finds the issue of religion and mental illness very interconnected. The purpose of this paper then will be to explore this theme in a variety of ways. To explore that nebulous boundary of religion and mental illness with similarities and differences highlighted. A Mormon murder, was it blood atonement or a capital crime? When Ron and Dan Lafferty were arrested in 1984 for the throat slashing and killing of their sister-in-law and young 15-month-old daughter, they stated that the trial had nothing to do with legal issues, but that in fact it was really a religious affair. They stated that the only purpose of any trial would be to convene a group. A little closer, okay, sorry. Yeah. If anyone can't hear, raise your hand, please. Thank you. They stated that the only purpose of any trial would be to convene a group of sincere and devoutly believing Mormon jurors and present them the case at hand. That case would be that God, through revelation and in a prophetic manner, to Ron Lafferty, gave the order and indication that their sister-in-law and child, as well as other people who could not be reached at that time, were to be removed or executed. The reason was, in quotes, they were interfering with the work of the Lord, and hence the only justification would be whether God could command the taking of life for higher spiritual purposes. Though not explicitly stated or claimed by the Laffertys at that time, was the implication that a divine law of blood atonement had been carried out upon people who deserved it. They then made references to the Book of Mormon, where Nephi kills Laban as justification for their action. Due to time limitations, I will not spend a great deal of time on the doctrine of blood atonement. I'll only summarize several facets of it. In Mormon theology, it is taught, has been taught from the beginning, that men may commit certain grievous sins according to his light and knowledge that will place him beyond the reach of the atoning blood of Christ. If then he would be saved, he must make sacrifice of his own life to atone, so far as is in his power lies, for that sin, for the blood of Christ alone, under certain circumstances, will not avail. In other words, the atonement of Christ can only go so far, and then your own blood must participate in the process if you are to be saved. There are many teachings concerning this, and all I want to highlight is this. It seems to me that the loose idea in many Mormons is that if someone commits a serious crime such as murder, then they should receive capital punishment and, most importantly, blood atonement as a religious punishment for this, so that this doctrine could be carried out. I would submit that most of the thinking about this is loose and irresponsible. If one even reads the teachings of Brigham Young, who gave more detail than anyone on this teaching and doctrine, it would seem to me that blood atonement, if it were ever applied in any strict religious sense, would be an ordinance in which an individual would have to go through all the procedures, having committed a capital serious crime, be judged, and then be given capital punishment as the punishment meted, and then and only then, after some religious experience of the individual, with a voluntary desire to participate in this ordinance, then seek to have blood atonement carried out upon him. Then the other requirement would be that the individual carrying it out for the state would also have to be a representative of the priesthood. And hence, the minimal requirements for an ordinance would then be carried out. But since the church and state have never been united, this has been pointed out by all Mormon authorities, Brigham Young in earlier years, and many other leaders, and most recently Elder Bruce R. McConkie. So that basically today the official teaching of the church is that blood atonement would really be a doctrine not carried out and would have nothing to do with capital crimes at the present time. What I see as most dangerous about this doctrine, above all, is that an individual may not volunteer for it. If that is the case, then it would seem to be more than ludicrous to suspect or even think that an ordinance efficacious in the eyes of deity was being carried out. And even more dangerous and erroneous is that any individual or individuals feel they can pass judgment on whether such a religious ordinance and practice should be carried out on someone else. This is particularly true when the question of mistaken identity occurs. Briefly, I'll also comment upon my bias against capital punishment as well as this doctrine. I think one of the greatest arguments against capital punishment, except perhaps in rare cases, in my opinion, is the serious danger of mistaken identity. In one study, for example, in the United States from 1930 to 1960, it was estimated that there were more than 300 people who were capitally executed mistakenly. In addition, many who are executed are seriously mentally ill. And then there are other arguments, I think, against this practice. Now let me move ahead to talk more specifically about the revelations of Ron Lafferty. If one examines carefully the background revelations of Ron Lafferty, particularly those surrounding the murder of his sister-in-law and niece, there are very interesting issues that arise. In fact, historical understanding of what happened to him was that he just simply had his whole life fall apart when his wife decided to leave him and get a divorce. He had a strong and deep attachment to her. And in fact, there was a feeling they had close to an ideal Mormon marriage. This was actually described in times prior to this murder, these murders. However, when he began identifying and following the path of his brother, who became very extreme and rigid in his religious views, conflict was engendered. His wife left, and at that point, his whole world fell apart, and he could not tolerate the loss. Rather than face a major depression that was incipient, he retreated into himself and became more identified with his brothers and others. And with this came intense preoccupation and displacement onto emotionally charged religious issues. He identified strongly with this role and finally became a prophet who got revelations for others as well as himself. In fact, he could not tolerate the aggression and anger he felt toward his wife. At one point, it would appear that he had murderous ideas toward her. But because he could not tolerate and accept the fact that she had left and would not come back. He finally gave her a writing of divorcement. He indicated to her that trials were necessary and that they had made a pre-existent covenant to be on earth together. He then noted that Satan was controlling her and that she was in great danger of losing her salvation. Then in a later revelation, amongst other things, it was stated in quotes in the revelation from God, "Nevertheless, if thou wilt speedily repent, I will greatly bless thee and thy children. Otherwise, I will remove thee from thy place." Then in another revelation shortly after this, there was detailed what had happened to Ron and his wife in the pre-existent spirit life. It was noted that Lucifer, or Satan, was a high military officer in the pre-existence. God the Eternal Father then asked someone to accept the challenge of fighting Lucifer and his hosts. One of God's six sons stepped forward, a leader, to carry out the spiritual warfare. This proved to be Ron. After much effort in spiritual warfare, Lucifer was cast down. The six mighty ones fought side by side. Ron had five brothers. However, the females of those who were cast down, i.e. Lucifer and his followers, all wept. They were now alone. Therefore, those who had been valiant, the six mighty ones who had cast down Lucifer, were given first choice of these female spirits to take as companions. He who had cast down Lucifer was given first choice, and he chose Lucifer's mate. Her name was Diana, a most beautiful female with great poise and great courage, much like her mate, Lucifer. Diana, of course, was the name of Ron Lafferty's wife. Later, when Diana was to go to Earth, she would rebel because of the darkness, and it would be dangerous for her because she would be deceived by her former mate, Lucifer, and he would try to destroy her. Later, after this revelation, in March of 1984, came the revelation, in quotes, "You should remove the following individuals," which included the sister-in-law, child, and others. Notice the word "removed" is the same in one revelation as the one warning about his wife. This whole sequence of revelations bears a closer scrutiny. What is especially interesting is that the revelation concerning the battle of the pre-existence and his, Ron's, overcoming the adversary Lucifer and him then saving the female mate of Lucifer from the latter's influence correlates strikingly with another vision. We need to review now briefly the vision of Mosiah Hancock, an early Mormon pioneer and saint. In this vision, known to many, an outline of Mormon teachings concerning the pre-existence are detailed. In that vision, Hancock is taken by the Lord to view pre-existent spirit life. It is noted that God the Father and His Son Jesus Christ, along with other great leaders, discuss how the plan of salvation will be carried out for the race of men who will get mortal bodies upon the earth. Six mighty ones who were faithful were on the side of the Father and the Son, and they led the way in supporting the plan of the Son, who had suggested a form of the plan of salvation to be carried out. This, of course, was opposed by Lucifer. Then one of the notable ones, the leader of the six, Michael or Adam, led the way to fight the battle against Lucifer and his cohorts. This group won, but it was noted that the females who were aligned with Lucifer and his group were left without partners. These were apparently assigned to some of these great leaders, but no mention is made specifically of Lucifer's mate and who took care of her. It is noteworthy that he who had the vision, Mosiah Hancock, has a particular place in it. In the beginning of the vision, he sees himself as being a companion to the Savior, Jesus Christ, and talks with him like a friend. He later saw himself as a teacher amongst the many classes of instructors that went on. Later, he is given his chance to go to Earth, and he prepares to go. At the end, Mosiah asks before his departure, which is near at hand in the vision, if upon return he could have the same position he then held. Then the Savior said, in quotes, "Yes, and greater, but you have to go down to the earth and take a lowly position and be misunderstood by man, even your brethren, and endure many hardships and set many examples of humility and patience, that you may return and enter the glory even such as I have." And thus Mosiah Hancock goes to earth. Comparisons of the vision of Mosiah Hancock and the revelation of Ron Lafferty clearly show a great deal of similarities. In fact, Ron in his revelation presumed that he was updating and giving a newer, clearer version of the vision Mosiah had. But comparisons of the two visions reveal striking differences. In the Mosiah Hancock vision, it is Michael or Adam, one of the valiant in the gods of Mormon theology, who leads the way in the fight for Lucifer in the pre-existence. He, along with Jesus Christ and others. Of note, it is Mosiah Hancock who has the vision and is a lowly, ordinary individual. In contrast, Ron Lafferty in his revision, it is he who is the great one, replacing Michael, who leads the battle in overcoming Lucifer. Second, in Mosiah Hancock's vision, the female mate of Lucifer and his colleagues are not dwelled upon, but they are given in relationship to other prophets and other notable individuals. No mention is made of giving them to Mosiah Hancock. In contrast, in the Ron Lafferty vision, it is Ron himself who takes the very wife of Lucifer, who in fact turns out to have the same identity as the name of his own wife in mortality. He then rescues her from her awful state of going with Lucifer. She is even warned that in returning to earth in a mortal state, she will be tempted to return to her former mate Lucifer because of darkness and rebelliousness. Third, in the Mosiah Hancock vision, he is sent down to earth in the role of being a lowly teacher who will be misunderstood and will have to work out his probation and salvation through humility and patience. In contrast, in the Lafferty revision, he is seen as the leader and the mighty one who is almost central to the whole plan of salvation process. In mortal life, he is, by later revelation, the one mighty and strong to lead all men to God. These differences are so important that to me they raise the specter of mental illness. Meeting the criteria from a psychiatric point of view of being a delusional system, A delusional system is defined as a false or erroneous idea about reality that becomes fixed and is not altered with new evidence and or is so extreme that it is not believed by anyone in the individual's environment. In terms of religious ideation, it is so extreme that it is not even supported by any, even in one's own group. To my knowledge, no one believed Ron Lafferty's revelations except himself and perhaps his brother. Again, without taking a great deal of time, I wanted to just highlight those differences to show that in looking at these two visions, one finds, I think, the difference in the personalities of the visionaries. Mosiah Hancock, who knows who he is, he's a mortal with limitations, living here in this life, yet with exalted possibilities. Whereas Ron Lafferty, in both states, does not know who he is. He is inflated on both counts. And yet it must be emphasized that in Ron Lafferty's revelation, he too is describing deeply significant spiritual experiences. But it is a comparison of the two that the boundary lines of religious experience and mental illness, I think, can best be illustrated. Religion and mental illness, what is the interface? Geertz described religion as a system of symbols which act to establish powerful, pervasive, and long-lasting moods and motivations in men. By formulating conceptions of a general order of existence and holding these conceptions with such an aura of factuality that the moods and motivations seem uniquely realistic. He further stated that any religious system was a cluster of sacred symbols woven into some sort of ordered whole. He then goes on to note that those who become committed to religion feel that it mediates genuine knowledge of the essentials of how life should have meaning and can be lived. Man or God fashions religion, as defined by Geertz, in a term I would like to call myth-making. But myth here is not defined as illusion, but as a coherent system of meaning and a way of life. Jung noted that myth is what is believed always and everywhere. Then Geertz notes that if the symbol system at the core of religion or mythology is uncriticized, either historically or philosophically, or if an individual ignores the moral system, the moral aesthetic norms in the symbol system, their lifestyle becomes discordant and becomes the basis for madness, or as we might translate it, mental illness. Mental illness in part then, and I only want to emphasize in part, I certainly don't want to be pretending as though I'm defining all of mental illness. Mental illness in part then could be defined as the failure of the individual to integrate the symbol system of his religious myth or life to the point that he either fails in living out the moral order of his culture or he fails to individually negotiate the passage of his own developmental stages in life from youth to old age and maturity. These failures would be so pervasive that he would suffer pervasive intolerable anxiety in all its derivative and symptomatic forms, delusions, nervousness, anxiety, etc. One of the hallmarks of mental illness generally is the inability to function in three areas, love, work, and play. Cohen, in a most insightful paper, noted that if one studies the Old Testament prophets, there is a manifestation of their behavior and religious experience that is strikingly similar to those of people who are profoundly mentally ill. For example, in Ezekiel 4:19 through 17, he is commanded by God to eat a variety of goods, including wheat, barley, beans, lentils, and then to lie on his side 390 days to eat. He is then commanded to bake barley cakes with dung that cometh out of man. Apparently, this is done to illustrate what the children of Israel had long been doing in terms of eating defiled bread from Gentiles. Then the Lord finally tells him in verse 15, "Then he said unto me, Lo, I have given thee cow's dung for man's dung, and thou shalt prepare thy bread therewith." As Cohen reflects rhetorically, are these evidences of psychopathological symptomatology of mental illness, or are they visionary religious experiences? Read the Old Testament sometime. That's just one example.
This is the end of side one. Please turn your cassette over at this time for side two.
The existence of man, the faith necessary to the enjoyment of life and salvation, never could be obtained without the sacrifice of all earthly things.
The prophet then went on to indicate that it was through the medium of this sacrifice that one then gained the knowledge that his course was pleasing in the sight of God. That is, Joseph Smith seemed to be saying that all biological, psychological, and social dimensions of one's life, all values, comforts, social connections, family, reputation, material objects of any kind, may need to be sacrificed or offered in sacrifice as to the test as to whether one will obtain the faith necessary to receive eternal life. But what are the dangers of this process? Why is it so difficult? Cohen noted that if the child or even the adult lets his environment, parents, and significant others mold his psyche and mind too extensively, he may never come to know his full and complete self, and hence be just an average man. Thus, the average man would not pass from the stage of the camel to the lion, and hence he would have a conscience and outlook adapted primarily to the collective from which he comes, but would lack the actualization and individuation more harmonious to his own unique nature. Though not outwardly sick or defective, it could be stated that he is experiencing the pathology of normalcy. It is only when the child or the adult asserts his own will, counter to much of his social and psychological history, often, that he can rise above himself and realize those higher potentialities within. In short, as Carl Jung stated, this would be the process of individuation. In terms of Joseph Smith, it would be the process of truly achieving a great faith, or I think it would also relate to the whole doctrine in Mormonism of making one's calling and election sure. It is in this process, however, the process of sacrifice to attain these higher values and to hear the higher call of deity, that invariably the threat of great imbalance, psychologically, spiritually, and emotionally, can and often does occur. With this imbalance of the psyche can come illness, or at least its appearance. There can be a distortion in function in all these spheres. There may be a concomitant, profound loss of self-esteem, inferiority, failure, and disintegration. In fact, as Nietzsche described in the phase from the camel to the lion, the genesis of mental illness often takes its place. In other words, if something goes wrong in making this ultimate decision for life, in sacrificing all, the individual may suffer anxiety to such a degree that he will be overwhelmed, regress, and become profoundly emotionally disturbed. To make this creative transformation requires a total reorganization of the individual's nature. Carl Jung, in describing this process, noted that it is no easy matter for the ego or conscious self to give up the very ground upon which it has survived to as yet unrealized higher powers and identities, coming from God, perhaps, or some other part of the self. If the ego is too weak or faulty or fragmented, serious states of confusion will take place. In the creative personality, however, quite the opposite result actually takes place. With the overwhelming influx and power of affective imagery related to godlike experiences, and with deeply profound spiritual experiences, their egos are solid and stable, and in fact are ready to give themselves up to this transformation. But to maintain their ground and their bearing in this real world, they do. They are able to know what goes on in this world versus the other worlds. And the results of this growth-centered process is indeed one of true change, wherein they move from a self-centered position to a more other-centered position in their relationships and to those about them. In fact, the results of their behavioral and object-related orientation to the world is opposite from that of the mentally ill individual, wherein a self-centered orientation becomes far more dominant and almost singular, with its tendency to ignore or use others in pathological, exploitive, and destructive ways. I was touched by Ogden Kraut's paper today as he quoted Joseph Smith about various kinds of revelations from God, man, and the devil. Revelations for man often are those that only exalt the individual and no one else. Thus, there is a fine line and at times an indistinguishable boundary in terms of the symptomatology and appearance of those who are having essentially a religious experience versus having a mental illness. There may be a mixture of both with emphasis on one side or the other. This is not an either-or or all-or-none process. It is a process of gradation. From this model, evaluations of individuals who claim specific religious experience can be gauged in sorting out what is religious versus what is psychiatric or emotional. But the model also now raises deeper and more disquieting questions about the collective behaviors of people particularly religious people in general. How often can it be stated then that people's religious activities and religious life are truly expressions of creative spiritual self-realization versus narcissistically preoccupying states in which people's own self-aggrandizement at the expense of others borders more in the area of mental or emotional conflict and illness? Another example of a recent Mormon murder is that of Mark Hoffman. While no specific claims to blood atone anyone was made, he nevertheless, in a calculated and premeditated way, murdered two individuals with some question of there being a third. Since this writer has never examined Mark Hoffman psychiatrically, no psychiatric diagnosis or commentary can be made, other than a few observations about having read responses in his depositions. What appears from his writings and descriptions by others is that, to me, of a deeply disturbed, amoral individual with psychopathic trends and a marked dissociation from affective values in life. In fact, the description I got from reading Mark Hoffman was the same description I got of hearing about the personality of Heinrich Himmler, the way he could talk about murder and this and that and himself. But if one looks behind the scenes as to what were the collective elements that fomented and set the stage for this kind of individual, painful realities need to be acknowledged in this culture. As Richard Howard, historian for the Reorganized Church, said to me, when individuals are isolated and their own religious outlooks are not honored or given at least some credence in the form of legitimate discussion, does this not produce the kind of isolation that breeds idiosyncrasy, anger, frustration, alienation, and hence aggression toward others? The answer to that question would have to be a painful yes. In part, then, I think we in the collective of Mormonism cannot completely exonerate ourselves from responsibilities for these religious tragedies that have evolved among us. We, too, of course, can play the old game of scapegoat and project and displace, much like the Ron Lafferty's or the Irvel LeBarons in what they have done. But how much have we really entertained the outcast, the odd, the different, the bizarre, and the strange? At least in tolerating discussion of people's viewpoints concerning such matters of religion and different views in life. One of the most dangerous traits and trends for any culture that claims to, in quotes, have the truth is the tendency to not see its blind side and its capacity to project its own shadow onto others and then identify with only that which is light and good and right from God and assume all others are different and belong to the devil. This is, in my estimation, one of the most serious, if not the most serious, problem we face in collective Mormonism today. Our inability to acknowledge or see our own shadowy side. How desperately do we need to hear, "And why beholdest thou the mote that is in thy brother's eye, but considerest not the beam that is in thine own?" Matthew 7:2. Or how many of us personally practice the 11th article of faith? We claim the privilege of worshiping Almighty God according to the dictates of our own conscience and allow all men, even other kinds of Mormons, the same privilege. Let them worship how, where, or what they may. For example, in the Mark Hoffman story, what is important to learn? If one examines the account of this tragedy, it truly casts a collective pall of shadow, darkness, and destruction at the very heart of Mormonism. Well might we ask the painful question as to all of our contributions to such an individual performing such unspeakable crimes. Who can say he is not guilty and responsible in some form? I personally recall how happy I was when his documents were found, and how unhappy and dismayed I was that they were found to be forgeries. And why? The reason was simply that it disappointed me in being able to have stronger evidence for my evolving views of Joseph Smith and early Mormonism. Or what of the document dealers who were uncritical and who, in excitement for more business and prestige, could profit on many fronts? Or what of the document forensic experts who were themselves initially fooled because they too would have had great prestige and participate in the excitement of such finds? And what of church leaders who were eager to buy up these documents of Hoffman, and for what reason? To control the Mormon past? To be there first? To have the better explanation if someone challenged them? Were they too eager to have something that seemed genuinely involved with the early Mormon church history that might disturb theirs and others' views? Was their own faith challenged and they denied it? What of the difficulty of acknowledging that they too were deceived like all the rest? Or what of the money spent on inflated markets? Or what of the scholars and historians who in their own researches felt buoyant and even inflated at how these documents supported their views of history, and yet how reluctant they were to see them die when forgery information began to emerge? Or what of the legal system and prosecution, who has become more interested in proving forged documents than in carrying out the ultimate demands of justice? How is it possible, asked some people in the legal profession, that a killer who murdered in cold blood was let to plea bargain to a second-degree murder? What was going on? Was this a capital crime ignored to save us all the embarrassment of seeing our own and facing our own shadows? Or what of the media, who may have been more interested in selling papers or books or sensational stories that at times could distort the truth, failing to report some things and over-reporting and sensationalizing others? Or what of the anti-Mormons, who could take bold attacks now in the LDS Church to hoot and howl as they verified their own distorted and extreme views concerning Mormon life and early Mormon history, particularly the life of Joseph Smith? And what of newspapers that would extol the confusion and disturbance of the documents and yet fail to acknowledge to their readers the changes in the Mormon community about the forged documents when the new information came in? Or what of the average church member who didn't want to be bothered because his faith would be too upset because he was too mentally lazy to take a challenge to his faith? Or what of the American public at large who now gleefully want to turn this gigantic failure in collective Mormonism and use it as a target to depotentiate and seemingly make irrelevant the serious contribution Mormonism can make to public American life? But equally so, on the other side of the coin, we can have mercy for ourselves and be forgiving too, as we try to soberly not only face and confront the shadowy aspects of our lives and participation in this collective tragedy, but also be forgiving of ourselves as well as others in an attempt to now soberly learn from this and move on to become more complete individuals and groups. After all, the truth is that any of us, no matter who we are, can be deceived by almost anyone else. Nowhere in history, as I know it, and specifically in the history of medicine, has it ever been shown that human beings are foolproof from being deceived, no matter how great their talent. And indeed, is self-interest always such a terrible thing? What kind of a world would we have if document experts, for example, did not seek to know and find new documents? Or what if forensic experts, who wouldn't dive in and take a chance on something new? Or what if church leaders, who didn't risk themselves in touching and trying to study the major events of Mormonism? What would have happened had they turned their backs entirely upon this and never looked at the discoveries? What kind of scholars would we have who themselves did not take chances of integrating new knowledge? What would happen if they were not on the firing lines trying to explore and understand better? Or what of the media who are trying to do their job and sort and ferret out myriads of pieces of information in thousands of hours of work? And so we can see that there's another side to it if we look at it with some compassion. This brings me to my, in trying to conclude, my bias against capital punishment. My trouble with those who are devoutly religious and who see singular and easy and neat solutions to the religious dilemmas of human beings is that they so often have failed to see life as it really is. While 90% of the people you see may fit neatly into your philosophical and religious view of what the world ought to be, what about those 10% that do not? For example, what would you say should happen to a woman who for 20 years put up with a harrowing experience of being attacked, beaten, threatened by an alcoholic husband who at times almost murdered her on numerous occasions? Then one time in her aging life, as she told me, he came toward her and made another verbal but harmless threat, and she, with a gun nearby, overreacted, as she stated it, and shot and killed him. Does she deserve to be convicted of first-degree murder? Does she deserve to be capital punished, blood atoned? Does she fit into the same criteria as Ron Lafferty or a Mark Hoffman? If one looks at the actual legal situation, this woman's premeditation in killing her husband is no different from these other crimes. After all, couldn't it be argued that this woman's alcoholic husband was a sick man, and no one ever attended to him, and he had to be able to find help? After all, even though she had been frightened 1,000 times by him, what right did she really have at this point to so respond? Albeit it was a moment of lapse, she alleged. So what kind of punishment does she deserve? You be the judge. Do you pull the trigger? Do you sentence her? For example, in most murders I'm aware of, some authorities have said 80%, they involve murders of various family members in fits of passion and rage in which there is later deep regret. The most startling experience in 20 years of practicing forensic psychiatry is to see the number of murderers who are, in fact, not very different from you or me, but who are only in many ways went to an extreme at one particular time and are very repentant. What is even more perplexing is what I have followed and examined in the dreams of multiple murderers over long periods of time and have found a startling thing. In these dreams and their unconscious productions, I have seen, sometimes in ever so small a way, but nevertheless present, a germ of healing and attempting to rectify that which seems almost unrectifiable. Conversely, I've seen in the religious productions, in what sometimes appear to be a most orthodox, devout, and religious person, covert things of aggression, destruction, deception, and fraud of an extreme degree. Or at times I've had a chance to have the sickening vision of looking at quotes at a righteous person's life and seeing the destructive havoc they have played on those around them in the name of good and deepened religious experience. All this to say that those who pretend to have religious experience, no matter who they may be, have an incredibly profound and awesome obligation to be true to themselves and to others, and be certain that their religious experience is productive of truly hopeful and altruistic ways of life. Our safest guide is to be able to tolerate our own shadows. In summary, then, I argue here that often symptoms of mental illness, which include anxiety in all its forms, represent ultimately a product of an individual's attempt to individuate and actualize himself. To put it in other terms, if you know what you absolutely cannot give up, you have at once identified your greatest value, hence your religion. But you have also identified your greatest potential weakness, or Achilles' heel, that can be overtaken by illness, mental illness, that can lead to your very powerful downfall and loss of what you prize most. Religion, spirit, and self-realization versus illness, loss, and death, all are infinitely connected, as I've tried to show. Might it not have been such a conflict and a set of polarities of these magnitudes that caused even the greatest of all, Jesus himself in the Garden of Gethsemane, to say to his Father, "Father, if it be possible, let this cup pass from me." But as we know, it was not possible. And in fact, it is not possible to each and every person who chooses the same path as he did. Thank you very much.
Just strides in where most of us fear to tread. Myself, I'd like to watch through the fence and hope to reel him back in when he gets too far out there. I'll clarify and illustrate what he said or what he should have said. First, there is three different entities, religious revelation, ecstasy, experience, two mental illness, psychosis, three criminality, including calculation of murder. I submit these are three distinct entities, can readily be distinguished if you have enough experience and have enough facts. I suggest you attempt to write the difference between a cat and a dog for someone who's never seen either animal. I can't, but I can tell you that, but I know a cat when I see one, I know a dog when I see one. And I likewise know the difference between being inspired, being crazy, being mean, if I have enough experience and enough exposure. And the limitation usually lies within me, as well as the objective facts. For example, I cannot recreate really what you did yesterday, try as I will, and I defy you to know what's in my heart. And also, I shrink back from the necessary experience. I live in awe of spiritual gifts, and I don't go seeking them out. They're more powerful than I want to take on. I shrink back from understanding really the overwhelming confusion of a deranged brain. I shrink back from really knowing from the inside what it's like to calculate how to slit a person's throat and have the life blood come down off my hands from the writhing body. I really don't want to know about that, and hence I don't understand it. Jess pushes into these areas, they are abhorrent, they offend us, but he does us a service. A second point, there's understanding behavior. Understanding's not the same as condoning it. And that holds no matter how mentally deranged or religious inspired it may be. I had a 3-year-old. We go into Safeways. I turn my back. One of those mysteries of childhood. But the tuna cans roll by themselves down the aisle. I contain the behavior, even when I understand it's a hot summer afternoon. But my understanding does modify my behavior. I don't say, look, you're the bad seed and an awful brat. It's home and nap time. So there's necessary restrictions on social behavior, even when our beliefs are different, and hence to our thinking, better. And that doesn't matter whether we're crazy or whether we're inspired. We live in this world. We live by its rules. A third point, any creed or instrument that has power for good has potential for evil, and the other way around. And the greater the power, the greater the danger. Puny religions don't inspire, not for good or for evil. The abuses evident in Mormon thought and life, whether murders, document forgeries, penny stock frauds, health food fadism, intolerant bigotry, superstitious gullibility, all these serve as reminders of the power of Mormonism and a reminder of the discretion and sobriety with which we may think to conduct our lives. A fourth point, we'll do well to be wary when claims of contact with the supernatural are self-serving. And that matters no matter who makes the claim. Now, I can't pass judgment on your claim for personal inspiration, but I know I'm more open to report of inspiration when the returned missionary tells me that the answer to his prayer is that he should leave my daughter alone and go find someone else rather than that she should marry him. When I have a sense of inspiration, I wait for some external confirmation of that. Maybe less comforted, but more secure in taking action on it. Fifth, any claim of inspiration that would force another human being is highly suspect, if not outright diabolic. Now, when my neighbor's inspired to live on wheat germ, sour milk, and dandelion greens, I don't envy his table, but I don't question his inspiration. Now, when he comes knocking on my door and says, Brother Owen, I'm inspired to have you live on wheat germ, sour milk, and dandelion greens, then my back bristles up and I say, hold it. Now, when a man's claim to priesthood authority would allow him to deprecate his wife's social striving, dictate the length of his adolescent son's hair, force sexual attention on his daughter, I reserve the right to question the authenticity and legitimacy of that claim. Because it isn't for him and his sacrifice, but he is sacrificing someone else for his self-aggrandization. Thank you. We have an affinity to the dark side of Ron Lafferty. What he did, we could do. Any deed of one human being is a deed, however inexplicable, dastardly, or disgusting, that we, sharing human protoplasm, are intrinsically capable of. We're all imperfect. We're all subject to evil. The consequences of Ron Lafferty's projecting his own unacceptable emotional dependency and his livid anger onto women around him is a reminder for us to accept our own shortcomings, our stupidities, our evil intentions. Not doing so exposes us in the realm of our own life to that self-same murder, in spirit if not in fact, of those people around us who have turned aside when they can't go our way any further than they've gone. And finally, we are all created in the image of God. We all have His breath of life in us. Any act, however misguided, irrational, or evil intended, can be used for good beyond our comprehension. That's an article of faith. That's not an established fact. Judgment is mine, saith the Lord. And I think sometimes our judgment comes at the end of our days, and I ask myself, what are we doing, judging one another and ourselves halfway through? Jess has seen a germ of healing in the inner self of mass murders. I would hope that contemplation upon the theme, his approach to it, a reflection, discussion of it, would help us move beyond that fence that separates us from the mysterious, from the disgusting, from the criminal, find the power within, the power above, give us health so we can help ourselves and one another.
I would like to personally thank both of these gentlemen for the very fine presentations they have given. They've given me a lot of food for thought, and I'm going to go back and reread their presentations and see to what extent I need to re-examine some things that are going on in my life that I found very intriguing. We have a few minutes for questions. Yes. Speak loudly, please.
Thank you very much. That makes a lot more sense to me than what we do. For example, I studied in detail all the capital crimes in Utah from the time of the territorial legislature. Anyone like to guess how many people have been capital punished, many of them blood atoned, in Utah since 1851? 44 up through about 1970. With Gary Gilmore and now, I guess, Bishop, we're looking at probably 46 or 47 people. What shocked me about the, looking at just brief histories were that about a third of them probably were mentally ill.
Any more quick questions? Yes. What was the diagnosis of Ron Lafferty?
Well, we felt he certainly had paranoia with a grandiose delusional system. He also had some strong symptoms of a bipolar disorder, and hence there probably were some family biological traits involved in that family situation. But that wasn't as strong as you might see. I mean, it wasn't as strong a diagnosis as one would like to have in a typical bipolar that you see often. But clearly he had a very, very clear paranoid reaction.
Yes.
Dr. Grossbeck, I wonder if you'd mind addressing blood atonement, capital punishment, self-imposed suicide.
Well, we ought to remember, that's an interesting question. Anyone who would like to think something uncomfortable, you know, Jesus committed suicide. He gave up his life voluntarily and when it was time. And in fact, a lot of Oriental people feel that suicide is the way to die, i.e. if you can die when it's your time. But of course, on the flip side of the coin, suicide in most cases, I would say, is just the opposite. It's a self-destructive, tragic event. And often it involves mental illness, though of course most people who commit suicide are not, in quotes, legally mentally ill. I would say I'd be highly suspect of most suicides involving a blood atonement. And ultimately, of course, I can't pass judgment on what a person does with their life if they really make an appropriate decision in the sense of not being mentally ill. I feel it my obligation that if indeed the decision is made out of particularly serious mental disturbance, then I would consider it my job, and I would want to stand on the side of those who say no, that person shouldn't take their life. But yet I remember some of the teachings about Jesus and the other great people of all time who say that may be the ideal way to go. Let's ask Dr. Clark. Noah, I'd like to hear your comment on that. That's probably more than I can say.
Yeah, suicide is problematic. We're shifting, I think, as a society and struggle with it. For myself, sometimes I think I wouldn't mind someone taking their own life when I look at what they're doing to the lives of other people and are determined to continue. My objection is to not people dying, but people dying untimely. And I hate to have people die and then the next day wake up and say, gee, that was a mistake. So if in doubt, hold off, because that's a one-way door.
I think we have to end right here. If any of you would like to talk further with these participants, you can come up afterwards.